Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
All right, welcome to Tax Tuesday. This is Toby Mathis, joined by our tax manager, Jeff Webb.
Thank you.
Hey, we're going to get jumping on here. We're just going to jump right in. No time like the present to just get business done. So first off, happy Tuesday. Second off, let's jump into a bunch of questions that have been asked. I've been getting a steady feed from folks even before we got started, and I'm sure I'll get more. I mean, I'm more than happy to answer your questions. I also got emails in from folks that I'm going to be trying to make sure I answer all of those, and we'll just make sure that we're getting through each and every question to the extent humanly possible within this hour. So first one is, what is Nexus and why do I care? Second one's going to be, does the IRS reimburse me for my corporate expenses? Third one is, how do I qualify for real estate professional? It's technically real estate professional status. What are self-dueling rules for nonprofits and QRPs? I'm going to throw in IRAs in there as well. Am I a dealer or an investor? What difference does it make? And those are the ones that we're going to hit one after the other in succession and make sure that we're getting through these. So first one is, what is Nexus and why do I care? Jeff, do you want to hit tax Nexus? Because there's different types of Nexus. There's physical presence for lawsuits and there's tax Nexus for taxation. I'm going to have Jeff hit the tax. And then I'll touch base on the physical nexus.
So when we're talking about tax nexus, what we're primarily talking about is a state's right to tax you on your income. For example, you may live in Nevada, have a rental property in California. California has a right to tax any income on that property because you're doing business within California. Now, there are different rules. There have been numerous cases on Nexus.
Most recently, our Supreme Court reversed a physical presence test that that Amazon and everybody that was an online retailer used to avoid state sales tax, and that was just changed.
Yeah, so on that one in particular, the Supreme Court, as Toby said, gave the states the right to tax online sales in their states. The thing is, the states now have to write tax laws to accomplish this. Most of the states don't have anything that accomplishes this.
A lot of times, ignorance is bliss. People would avoid sales tax. Like, for example, when I lived in Washington, people would go over to Oregon and avoid the sales tax. And they ignored Washington's use tax. A lot of states have this. You don't pay sales tax and you go someplace where there is no sales tax, you still owe sales tax on it, but they call it use tax because you brought the physical item into your state and you never paid sales tax on it. So then they would say, aha. And the really interesting thing, there was some actually really interesting cases that that were popping up from the Nexus. One of the ones that came out of Washington was Northwest Energetic Services 2. And that was a case in California where they tried to tax an organization that was registered to do business there that didn't actually do any business in California, but they wanted to tax its worldwide revenue. And the Franchise Tax Board or the Board of Equalization lost that one, and they had a few others. But what you'll find is that this is a continuously active and generating area of tax law, and we tend to fall into the category of ask for forgiveness, not for permission all the time, because if you ask a state whether you should be paying tax, they will gladly say yes, even if it's not a legitimate tax. They'll tell you that you have to pay it, even though it's made to be unconstitutional, unlawful, you fill in the blank, even if you don't owe it, they'll oftentimes just answer yes, of course you should. They can't actually be giving you any tax advice anyway, so it's the wrong party to be asking. I'm sure, Jeff, you get to deal with that a lot
yeah,
more than
and,
I
have. And a state like California, it used to be an old joke for the CPAs that you could be flying over the state of California and making a business phone call in California. You would want to say you have Nexus and we can now tax you.
Yeah.
They're also a state that's very difficult to leave if you're a resident. We had a case where somebody, NBA player for the Sacramento Kings, moved, was traded to Washington Sonics and moved there. And
Seattle Sonics?
I mean, Seattle Sonics.
Yeah, they're the Oklahoma City Thunder. I was there when they moved. Horrible.
But the state of California wanted to say, no, you're still a resident of California. We're still going to keep taxing you because you have friends here and you have club ownerships and relationships. And so California in particular is very tenacious with Nexus.
Yeah. And so you're going to see things evolving over the next few years, since the Supreme Court decision was literally this last, I think it was just months ago.
Right.
And end of the year, last year. You're going to see states trying to fill in the blanks. And so you have some states, for example, in drop shipping, Pennsylvania would tax you if you drop ship out of their state where they used to not be. Other states did before. We were talking earlier before the webinar, Jeff and I were, and he was talking about, what is it, like a clawback or what do they call
it? Yeah, it's called a throwback rule that says if your sales into a state that doesn't have taxes, then wherever it got shipped from can tax it instead.
Mm-hmm. Somebody just asked, what are the worst three states for Nexus? I mean, it really depends on, you know, what you're doing, but I would say just off the top of my head, probably New York, Connecticut, and California. Yeah. Are pretty heinous. Look at the states that just filed the lawsuit against the federal government under the SALT limitation, which is the state and local tax limitation. You'll see that I think there was four states, Maryland was one of them, where they try to hit you with so many different taxes. And it doesn't, it's not just business, it's on your personal as well. It's just for a Nexus, for a person, it's really easy to figure out, hey, where do you live? Because, and I say it's easy, it can be difficult if you have two residences that you spend time with equally. They're going to add up things like how much utility you use, where your driver's license is, where your kids go to school, where your vehicles are registered. You're going to look at those types of things.
Yeah.
And there's the Hyatt v. Commissioner case, or what was it? Hyatt versus Board of Equalization, I think is actually what it was, where a gentleman moved to Nevada and the California Franchise Tax Board sent agents to Nevada to climb through his garbage and break into his apartment to prove that he was actually residing in more in California than he was in Nevada, because his tax bill would have been so great. And when they got caught, they said they're immune. And our Supreme Court, and Scalia, I remember the opinion, was scathing on them, saying, no, you're immune in your jurisdiction. When you cross those state lines, don't expect any immunity. And they just harassed that poor guy, you know, climbing around his house. So let's just narrow it down, though. So you asked a question, what is Nexus? There's two sides. There's tax nexus, and then there's physical nexus. In the physical nexus, again, where you reside, it's pretty easy. If you live there, then you have a physical nexus in that state. It's where you have a house. In a business, it's no different. In a business, you have to decide where it's going to have its main presence. And the courts have held having a bare office and nothing more isn't going to be sufficient. You actually have to do something there. And that's when you actually have to have a physical office space. And so we use virtual office, where it's doing more than just maintaining a registered agent. There, we're actually giving conference facilities, phone answering. We'll do document prep and things like that for the governance of the company, so the company can actually have a physical presence. And the reason that you do that is to make sure it has a home. So if somebody's coming after one of its shareholders or members, one of its owners, that it does not draw that entity into the state where they're located. So if I have owners in a company and I have my company set up in Wyoming and they sue me in Nevada and they sue somebody else in Texas and somebody else in Florida, you don't have a choice between the Nevada, Texas, and Florida where the shareholders are, or the members of the LLC are located. They would actually have to go to Wyoming where the actual entity is located. And that's what you're trying to do. So if Anderson does my meeting notes, that's why it's important. Yes, Al, that's exactly why.
which allows you to cross in and out of shorter borderline because you already have been pre-cleared. Oh, there's a Nexus card. Yeah, Nexus is, we're not talking about Canadian, U.S., the Nexus pass. You guys are good. Skiers love, of course. I could tell you a fun one. We had a client that just got nailed by California. It's actually under the FBAR regs, which is foreign bank account regulations. They had some interest on a bank account that was there for a condo they had in Whistler, and they sold the condo in Whistler, and they didn't report, I think it was like $70, $76 worth of interest. And Jeff, do you know these off the top of your head, how much penalty it is?
No.
If the IRS catches you, it's 50% of the account balance per year. But if you go under amnesty, which they had an account, take them into amnesty, it was a $38,000 fine, which they paid for that $76. So Canada is still offshore. Anyway, so what is Nexus and why do I care? It gets a little convoluted, but the reason you care is you don't want to draw your company into your estate. You want to make it very difficult for somebody to get a hold of your assets if they're coming after you. From a tax standpoint, it matters because we want to keep our business activities to the extent possible in the lowest taxing jurisdiction as humanly possible. So that's that one. Jeff, this is one of your favorites, I know. Does the IRS reimburse me for my corporate expenses?
No, of course they do. IRS is ending really giving out money. We get this question more often than you would think. I think it's a misconception that clients are being told that their companies can reimburse them for certain expenses, mm-hmm. Which will reduce their taxes. And sometimes the clients are hearing IRS is going to reimburse us. The only time you get back money from IRS is if you've paid money into IRS for taxes, mm-hmm. and you don't owe them any tax, or maybe you overpaid them.
Yeah, IRS is a policing agency. Your taxes, when you pay it, they don't even go to the IRS. It goes to the U.S. Treasury. So the IRS is merely, hey, pay my boss is all they are. So they don't give any money out whatsoever. So the IRS does not reimburse you for your corporate expenses. What the IRS does is enforce the laws, which is the United States code, and it issues regulations interpreting that code and is basically the enforcement arm for the U.S. Department of Treasury. What ends up happening for corporation is they're allowed to reimburse shareholders many expenses that are not included on the shareholders' personal tax return. So it sometimes seems like they're giving you money, when in all reality, they're allowing you to not pay tax on your expenses, which is always the battle because there's lots of rules out there that say things are not deductible.
Correct. You know,
nothing more telling than what we just had happen in this tax change where they eliminated all miscellaneous itemized deductions. All of them are gone, in case you've been sleeping in 2018. You do not get to write them off anymore.
So now that's your union dues, your tax preparation fees, your
any unreimbursed business expense. If you're a teacher and you're providing stuff for your classroom, you don't get to write it off.
If you're paying substantial amounts to your broker for advisory fees.
That's a huge one. We're going to see that one come back and bite people on the katush.
Yeah, that's no longer deductible.
Yeah, so it's horrible. So, no, the IRS does not reimburse you for your corporate expenses. Your corporation reimburses you for corporate expenses, and the IRS lets you write it off. Let me see. How do I qualify for real estate professional status? Jeff, do you want to play with this one, or do you want me to handle?
I'll do a little, and then you can correct me. So real estate professional has a hours commitment. I believe it's 750 hours a year.
So it's a minimum of 750 hours, but there's a second part to that too. You know that.
And the 750 hours can be earned by you or your spouse. What's your second one?
The second one is it has to be the number one use of your personal professional time.
No, correct.
Right. So the way I always explain this is if you did 1,001 hours doing bicycle repair, and you did 1,000 hours of real estate, you do not qualify as a real estate professional. But if it's reversed and you did 1,000 hours of bicycle repair and you did 1,001 hours of real estate activities, then you do.
And the reason this is important is because ordinarily your real estate expenses are offset your real estate income, and you can only take losses from real estate. In other words, the excess depreciation or repairs or whatever, your losses are limited to $3,000 a year against your other active income. So that's called the passive activity loss rules.
$25,000.
Oh, if you materially participate. Then you have a $100,000 to $150,000 scale up.
Yeah, right.
There's some little nuances which don't burn your head with. The end of the day is there are restrictions on taking passive activity loss. Real estate professional status removes that restriction. The other thing that's really important about real estate professional status is it is per property. So if you have three properties, you'd have to meet it for each of the three unless you elect to aggregate all your properties on your tax return. We have seen this missed by accountants who don't do real estate.
Mm-hmm.
They don't aggregate, and there are actually cases on the book where people had to fight, and they literally had tons of properties. They easily met the 750 if you aggregated, but their accountant missed the aggregation election.
And the 750 IRS is not just for your rental properties.
Any real estate activity.
Any real estate activity.
Yeah. And then Jeff was absolutely right. Your spouse could qualify, either you or your spouse, if you're filing jointly.
So if you have a full-time job and you're getting a W-2, I can guarantee you that you will not legally qualify.
Mm-hmm.
Under audit, you're going to lose. However, if you have a full-time job and your wife does not or your husband does not, they can qualify to be that real estate professional.
Yeah. We had a fun one. A good friend of ours and a colleague in Georgia is making somewhere between $2 and $3 million a year in his professional practice. And his wife qualified as a real estate professional, and he quite literally bought enough commercial property and did something called cost segregation, where you're rapidly depreciating it, where he generated enough loss off the real estate to offset his income. The IRS audited, he self-represented because he knew the rule, and it withheld. It stood up. His wife just did their real estate activities, and he did their practice. And at the end of the day, she met the requirement for the real estate professional status, and the rule is pretty straightforward. IRS didn't like the outcome, but that's not their job. So they picked a fight, lost the audit, which is not uncommon. All right, so how do I qualify for real estate professional? Keep a log of your time and make sure that you're aggregating all of your real estate activities. Even if it's for a closely held company, it's still gonna match. Still gonna work. Next one, what are the self-dealing rules for nonprofits and QRPs? I'm gonna add in there IRAs as well. Since when we talk about a qualified retirement plan, we're really talking about 401k and 401a. And this is gonna dovetail in with one of our other questions that came in off the internet as well. But here's how it works. If you are in a particular type of entity, where it says you cannot interact and engage in business with a disqualified person, you could not sell them a $1 million building for a dollar. It is an absolute prohibition against self-dealing. And so that's the most important first step, is determining whether or not you're within one of those rules. Then if you are, then you look and say, are there any exceptions to that rule? So for nonprofits are going to fall into broad categories. Foundations, private foundations are one. These are nonprofits that aggregate money and give money to other nonprofits. They don't do anything. And in that one, you have an absolute bar from self-dealing. The next one is an operating nonprofit that is doing something. And in that case, you just have to use arm's length transactions. So we look at that. That's our step number one. So let's go back to the first one, private foundations. Then you look and say, are there any exceptions? The only exception is reasonable compensation. You can always be reasonably compensated. But other than that, no more transactions. So for nonprofits, 501c3s, you can enter into transactions as long as it's an operating nonprofit. It can give you benefits, it can pay you, and it can engage in sales and other transactions between you and it, so long as they are
arm's length. And the way you make sure it is arm's length is you have non-interested parties looking at it saying, hey, that looks okay to me. Somebody who's not, doesn't have a dog in the fight. Now we go to QRPs and IRAs. In either one of those, you have absolute prohibitions against self-dealing with disqualified parties. And disqualified parties are lineal descendants, which would be grandparents, children and their spouses, great children and their spouses. It does not include your siblings. So what's interesting is you could actually engage in transactions with your IRA, for example, and loan money to your brother. You cannot loan money to your mother. You could not loan money to your kids or your grandkids. You could not do a second on their house. You could not do anything between the company. You could not buy a house from them. It's that is an absolute bar. That's called a disqualified party. Go ahead.
And the way I kind of look at it as to whether you may be violating self-dealing rules is, are you benefiting from a transaction between you and the nonprofit or the QRP or the IRA?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what they're out to prevent. And unfortunately, the rules are pretty severe for violations of the self-dealing.
If you self-deal, you're just going to disqualify your IRA.
Yeah.
If you're using a QRP, using a 401k, then we have different rules. And in that particular case, it will just disqualify the money that you actually were utilizing. They're far more lenient.
I had a client who had a QRP. It was actually a defined benefit plan who had a required minimum distribution to make. And the plan was not funded at the time. So the client had to make a loan to the QRP, which is a self-dealing.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, there's an exception for that, that the loan was quickly repaid. There was no profit or interest earned on it.
Was it within the 60 days?
I believe it was within 60 days.
So they just used it as almost like a rollover. There's some more fun stuff. So then we go into 401ks, and this is where you get into people acting on behalf of the company. And I know that there were some questions that were already posed in the chat feature here. But if you're not supposed to be getting any personal benefit or using those funds at all when you have an IRA or a 401k. In an IRA, it's much more severe because you have a custodian. So if a renter, for example, is paying you money and they pay it to you individually, technically you have a violation of the self-dealing rules because you just received money. Even if you go ahead and put it right back in the IRA, you're going to have an issue because technically you weren't supposed to be receiving the money. The custodian was supposed to be receiving the money. So you should actually have rental money going back into going to your custodian if you're using an IRA. If you're using a 401k or a 401a, which is a profit sharing plan or a 401k, then you are the trustee and you're able to accept the monies and endorse it right into the account and make sure that the money goes to the right place. IRAs are a little more difficult. So to get around this, a lot of people with IRAs will set up an LLC, which you can be the manager of. You're actually the IRA is technically the member, and you're in a non-compensated role. And we have to make sure that the LLC agreement says that. If we drafted it, then we make sure that we're putting in the non-prohibition rules. You cannot personally benefit from any of these activities. It has to all go back to the retirement plan. So people will do the LLC and they will be, all right, now I can go ahead and accept the funds through the LLC. That's how they do it with an IRA. If you're doing it with a 401k, we're going to suggest that you still set up an LLC anytime you have real estate, just because we don't want the liability to flow through to you. But there, now you don't need the custodian. You could technically do it inside the 401k directly, though you should still have the LLC. And it's the same scenario where you're able to accept the proceeds. That's not going to be a technical violation because you are acting on behalf of the plan. And that is not a violation of the self-dealing rules. So the biggest takeaway from all this is that you can act on behalf of a plan. The second a disqualified person starts to get personal benefit, you have violated the rules. And if it's an IRA, the whole thing is
is violating, considered a taxable event, which would be the 10% penalty plus income tax on it for the entire amount. And if it's a 401k or 401a, it would just be the portion that you violated. So, you know, we tend to be very bullish on using 401ks and 401as, the profit sharing plans around here, also known as a QRP. And this is why, because they're far more forgiving and they have less moving pieces. So I hope that explains that. We're going to have, I know there's a couple more questions that are in here that are going to be relevant to this section as well. Let me jump onto something. Oops. The questions. This is something you can ask detailed questions via our email. I will answer them, and Jeff or Tony, whoever's from the tax department's here, we will answer these on the Tax Tuesday. We'll also more than likely be responding back out to you directly as well, because we want to make sure you're getting your questions answered. But just jot down that address, webinar@andersonadvisors.com, and feel free to shoot them in. Since our last one, Tax Tuesday, we had a couple of questions, and I wanted to go through these. Number one was from Karen out of Alaska. I have a revocable trust in Alaska that owns and sells real property. Does the trust pay income taxes on the profit, or does the profit end up on my personal tax return? And is it taxed at the same rate as everything else? So the most important word she used in her question was revocable, because trusts come in two flavors, revocable or irrevocable. If they're irrevocable, then we have two choices. That we don't have to worry about the irrevocable portion. Since it's revocable, it's a grantor trust, it's ignored. It's you for tax purposes until you're dead. So you're good. Sorry, sometimes I'm blunt. But it is taxed just, so if you're buying and selling real estate, real property, it's taxed no differently than if you own the real property. Now here's the rub. It also gives you no asset protection. So a revocable trust is giving you no asset protection with that real property. So I would really strongly suggest that the revocable trust actually be the owner of an LLC that is buying and selling the real estate. And depending on how quickly you are turning this will depend on whether that's a S or a C corp, if it's a flip, versus if it is a long-term holds, then we just put it as an LLC, and it would either be disregarded or taxed as a partnership. We want it to flow under our return. But those are kind of our, there was a question that I don't know if I got to that. I'm going to skip back to our slides. There was something about, am I a dealer or an investor? So I want to make sure that I'm getting this one right here, because this is relevant to that, to one of these questions. A dealer or an investor is something that we talk about in real estate. Do you want to hit on this?
No, you're doing fine.
I know Jeff likes to. One of us is a talker. All right. So an investor is someone who's passively involved. A dealer is somebody who's actively buying and selling real estate. So if you buy real estate with the intent to hold it for its long-term appreciation and cash flow, then you are an investor. If you buy real estate with the intent to sell it, then you are a dealer. And the easiest way to conceptualize this is, if I am an investor, I am passive. If I am a dealer, then I am a supermarket with inventory.
Correct.
And I'm putting my real estate on a shelf and it's constantly for sale. And just like at your grocery store, it may take a couple years for something to sell. I'm just imagining the items that are on the shelf or
your non-durable goods.
Yeah, your
durable goods, yeah.
Right. So you sell something. I used to do liquidation. We would grab all the expired items. You know, it was kind of we'd sell them. But let's say it doesn't matter how long you held it. A lot of people think, well, if I held it over a year, I can't be a dealer. That's not the case. We actually have cases on the books where they held it over 10 years. What matters is what your intent was when you bought it. And the difference it makes is active income versus passive income. The difference is an investor can 1031 exchange and defer all their taxes. An investor can get long-term capital gains. An investor can do installment sales. An investor can spread out the tax liability over a long period of time. Whereas a dealer is active. It's subject to
Social Security taxes. It's taxable immediately, even if you don't receive the money. It is active ordinary income. It's no different than I just sold that box of Cheerios on the shelf that I've been waiting to sell. And it makes a huge difference. Dealer activity, we're going to isolate inside of an S-Corp or a C-Corp. Investor activity, we're going to make sure it flows onto your personal return, either by using a disregarded LLC or a partnership LLC, one of the two.
And you know, intent has really made a difference in a couple of cases. One where somebody bought a property that they're going to allow their child to live in, something ended up happening, and they sold it after a short time.
Yep.
They were considered to be an investor, not a dealer.
It doesn't even matter. Like, it does not matter whether you ever rented it. There's plenty of cases where somebody tried to rent it and they were going to use it as a long-term hold and then things changed and they sold it. Just know that if you buy or sell within a year, you're going to be, the presumption is going to be that you're a dealer.
Right.
If you hold for over a year, the presumption is going to be that you're an investor, but it's not a guarantee.
If you are a real estate investor, trader, or business owner who wants to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and build future wealth, then you need to attend the next 3-day tax and asset protection event sponsored by Anderson Business Advisors. At the event, podcast hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman will discuss the art of building generational wealth, ninja equity stripping strategies to discourage lawsuits, the reason to forget LLCs for real estate, tax strategies to stay out of the IRS crosshairs, avoid the joint venture chamber of horrors, and much more. The Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection event is held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Join us for the next 3-day tax and asset protection event and network with other investors and business owners while learning strategies to build your wealth and help you sleep better at night with a solid peace of mind knowing you have prepared for anything. Learn about the next event dates and locations by going to AndersonAP.com and register today. That's AndersonAP.com to register. AndersonAP.com.
And we're going to get back to these questions. There we go. How does Flip LLC income flow into S-Corp? And then what will be distributions and salary? So we talked a little bit about this last week, but we're going to go and we're going to hit this. When you set up an LLC, it doesn't exist to the IRS. So when you say, how does a Flip LLC flow into S-Corp? It doesn't. A Flip LLC is an S-Corp if you elect to have it treated that way with the IRS. So the income is just going into an S-Corp. Then you have to decide what your salary will be. Because if you know anything about an S-Corp, you want to make sure you pay yourself a reasonable salary if it's making money. The rule of thumb to use is 1/3 of your net income should be paid out as salary. That's just a rule of thumb. But it's all in all reality. The IRS has this funky test where you're supposed to say, hey, what would it be? What could it be paid? And yada, yada, yada. They have it, you know, just they never tell us exactly. So I'll just say this. Pay 1/3, don't worry about it. If you get too much money, if you start making over $300,000, then we're going to have a chat. But you're going to be on our radar anyway, and we're going to be making sure that you're paying a reasonable salary anyway. And the reason this is important is because the salary is subject to old age, death, and survivors and Medicare, also known as FICA or Social Security, and the distributions are not. So what you would do is you'd be cutting your Social Security tax by about 2/3 if you did it that way. And I hope that explains it. So it makes its money and it pays it out. We do need to make sure that if you're flipping, that the money goes into the LLC.
Hey, and a quick comment on distributions in an S corporation. Distributions are typically the money that's already been taxed and you're just pulling the cash out. Mm-hmm. What you don't want to do is go out and get a bank loan in your S corporation and take distributions from that for several reasons. One, you don't have basis in those distributions. Two, it gets into the whole finance distribution issues and things of that nature. So you really only want to be pulling money out of the company that you've already been taxed on.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And then if you don't pull any money out of an LLC that's taxed as an S-corp, you don't technically have to pay yourself a salary.
Correct.
You just let it sit in there and keep growing. All right, which your accountant is not going to tell you because they don't know that. And the reason I know that is because I've spoken to probably 100 accountants that missed that one. Let's see. It says, why do you want the LLC that does flipping set up as an S-corp or C-corp instead of a partnership? Mark, we were just talking about that because it's taxed as ordinary income and subject to self-employment tax. So the reason we want that in an S or C is so that you do not get classified as a dealer, because then all of your real estate is dealer real estate, and you could lose all your long-term capital gains. You could lose your 1031s. You could use your installment sale. So we want it to be a separate taxpayer from you, so the IRS knows clearly who the investor is and who the dealer is. And then you can reduce the amount of tax hit by using the S-corp. It'll reduce your self-employment tax significantly. And if you add a 401k to it, it could illuminate your tax or defer it out into the future. If you use a C-corp, then depending on what your expenses are, we could also eliminate all your tax or at least reduce it significantly. So that's why we use that. All right. We have a whole bunch of questions to go through. So I'll go through this. What is UBIT and UBIT? Well, UBIT is unrelated business income tax. And the easiest way to understand this is when you have a tax deferred entity or a tax, it's not actually a tax free. It's really, it can be a tax free if it's a Roth. But when you have a qualified plan or a nonprofit, and it is not doing what it's set up to do. So let's say an IRA or a 401k or a 401a or a nonprofit, they're all set up to do certain things. They're allowed to have passive activity, which is rents, royalties, dividends, interest, even capital gains. And it can have those and you don't have to worry about it at all. But once it starts competing with other businesses, active businesses, now you have an issue, and that's what's called – somebody says this is so much fun. Really? Yeah, I like it. And so let's say that you have these ordinary businesses. Then they would be taxed at – generally speaking, it's going to be the highest rate at 37%, I believe is what it's going to be, as kind of a disincentive to engage in traditional businesses inside those exempt organizations. So the easiest way to look at it is, let's say you set up an IRA and it runs a mini mart. You're going to pay tax on those profits just like anybody else would. The exception is if that IRA owns a corporation that does not pay out the profits directly. It would have to own a C corp, and then it would only receive dividends, and then those are considered passive. So it gets funny, a little bit difficult. The other one is, let's say you set up a nonprofit that's for helping vets, and then it sets up a pizza business on the side and starts competing with it buys a bunch of Domino's franchises. It's going to pay tax on the Domino's franchises. It doesn't get a big, huge competitive advantage selling pizzas because it's a nonprofit. It would have to be for its charitable purpose, and that's UBIT.
And one place we see it a lot is like hospitals are usually tax exempt. But they may have a gift shop, mm-hmm. which they have to pay the business income tax on, because it's not directly supporting them, but it is. But it is a business.
But you're allowed to do that for Salvation Army and some of these other thrift stores. They'll let you have one for a church or whatnot if it's ancillary. If it's completely ancillary, then it's just being used. Like thrift stores, I think, are one of the few exceptions.
Right.
Gift shop, absolutely. You're head-to-head. Here's another one, and I think that this may be what Diane was looking at. It's debt-financed income, and what that is if I'm using leverage, then there's an exception for IRAs where it cannot use loans to generate income. It's considered unrelated debt-financed income, and it will be taxable. That is not the case for 401ks and for 401as, which is why if you've ever been through one of our events, you hear us railing on the idea that if you're going to finance real estate, real estate is considered passive and it's considered okay and not UBIT. The only way you make it taxable is if you leverage it inside of an IRA. So don't do that. If you're going to leverage it, make sure you're rolling that IRA into a 401k or a profit sharing plan, which is a 401a. So there, that's my two cents. I figure that maybe they had a funky UBITA. I have no idea what that is, but it looked neat. So I think they were probably referring to debt financed income, since those things usually go side by side. All right. We have a ton of questions that have been posed, and this is so much fun. We have like literally a gajillion questions, if that's a number. All right. So here's the first one. If I cash out, refinance, or borrow an equity loan for my primary residence, use the money to do private lending, buy rental property, can I deduct the interest expense as an investment expense beyond the $750,000 amount? So they're throwing some things in here. This is actually a really long question. I'm giving you the thumbnail sketch of it. Hey guys, email those types of questions in, because nobody's going to be able to follow this. But here's what they're saying. We now have a restriction on your mortgage interest. It's $750,000. If you borrow on your house, and by the way, it's $750,000 now. If you had a loan on it up to $1 million, you're grandfathered in. If it was prior to, what was it, December 15th, 2017, you're good. Or if you got your loan before April 15th and you'd already started the process before December 15th, don't you make my head hurt, right? Long and short of it is, let's just say $750,000, but your house is worth $1.5 million. So you borrow money out of your house. You will not be writing that off personally. You are capped at $750,000, and that's on your Schedule A. So, you know, whether or not you're getting any benefit out of that is to be seen, because you have your standard deduction. I imagine it's going to be above the standard deduction if you're borrowing over, you know, up to $750,000. Let's just say we have our $750,000 and we borrowed an extra $500,000. It can't go on your Schedule A, but it can go someplace else. The someplace else would be, for example, if I put it onto my Schedule E because I'm using it to buy rental property. Then I can use the income of the rental property, and I can use the interest being paid as a separate expense. It's just going on a different tax form. The other route that you can go is if I give that $500,000 and I loan it to a corporation and the corporation reloans it. In other words, the corporation is going out and loaning its money out, and it's reimbursing my interest. Then in all reality, the loan is really to the corp. And I'm not getting any tax benefit, but the corporation is reducing its income by reimbursing me the right to use my line of credit. And this is no different than if you did this with your credit card. It's reimbursing you. So you make no money on it, but you don't pay tax on it. So that's a fancy workaround. That's number one. Next question. I hold rental property in a self-directed IRA. I do tenant screening, manage the rental, hire vendors to do the repair work, and I don't physically work on the house. Good, because you can't physically work on the house. You can do everything else. You can hire, do screening. I would actually have a property manager on it. All income expenses come and goes to the same self-directed IRA account. Hopefully that's with the custodian, or you have an LLC disregarded to the IRA. And somebody asked this. The IRA custodian sets up the LLC. You can't do it. Like, you shouldn't be going out and doing it yourself, paying your money. You should actually have the IRA do it to keep it clean. Is it allowed? Yes. Some people say, if only I don't work on the house myself, that's okay. And they're correct. Some people say even screening, collecting rent is not allowed. Can you please clarify? You should not receive the money. The IRA should receive the money. You can direct it to the custodian, though. In fact, you can even get the check and hand it to the custodian, forward it to the custodian, whatever, as long as what you're doing is not adding value to the property. That's what's the big no-no. Don't go get a paintbrush and start painting the house, because you're increasing the value through your personal efforts. Next question. My wife's previous employer stock options were exercised, and we feel have peaked. Cost basis 132, market value 280. If we cash in, what will be the tax consequences? And how can we reduce the tax burden? We need to pull the trigger shortly. So, Aziz, this is you.
there's two ways you can do this. First off, you're going to end up with long-term capital gains, so it's not horrible. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there's a something called an opportunity zone, and this was just enacted at the end of the year, and they just published out all these zones. If you reinvest the money in a opportunity zone, you defer the tax. In the opportunity zones, there's tons of them. It's any neighborhood that is considered that needs public support, and there's a laundry list. I would actually encourage you to go Google opportunity zone tax, and you'll find a big old list. But there are communities in your area that are typically low to moderate income housing. If you took your entire amount of increase, so let's say that we have $150,000 of taxable capital gains, you could buy $150,000 of opportunity zone properties and pay zero tax. Now, the question is, what happens when I sell? So there's holding periods, and the minimum holding period, I believe, is you're going to be looking at 5 years, where then you're going to not have to pay tax on 15%. I'm going off of memory, so you'll have to excuse me if I'm not spot on, but it's 15%, then it jumps up, and at 10 years, the entire $150,000 is no longer taxable. And I believe that you're not going to be paying tax on the gain in the opportunity zone. It's kind of a two-prong. Are you familiar with that one, Jeff?
Somewhat. I know they replaced the old enterprise zones a number of years back.
Yep. So something to look at, but that would be it. The last way to avoid tax is give them, before you exercise it, is give that to your nonprofit if you have one, and you would get a $280,000 deduction, and then the nonprofit can sell it and pay zero tax. So you'd get a monster tax, and you could do this halvesies too. You could say, hey, I really need to offset a bunch of the tax, so I'm going to make a contribution. It doesn't matter what your basis is. It only matters the fair market value of those assets. So if you transferred, let's say, $140,000, half of it, let's say you transferred $140,000 worth of stock, you would get a $140,000 tax deduction, and it can offset your income up to 60%. So in either case, I feel pretty confident that we could mitigate or eliminate that tax bill if you wanted to. Here, let me jump up. We got lots of questions. These ones we kind of answered. Somebody says, if you keep it out of state for 3 to 6 months, can be avoided? I'm not certain. I don't understand that. Must have been something earlier. Next is Carter. I already got that. Okay. I am helping a friend with crowdfunding project, and due to medical needs, we'll need a large sum. Maybe around $1 million. What would his tax consequences be if he has no deductions? Does he have to pay tax on donated money? Fred, generally speaking, if you're getting these little gifts, as long as they're less than $15,000, there's no tax. And when I say $15,000, that's per donor.
Correct.
So if I do a crowdfunding and everybody gives $100, there's no tax to the recipient. So go ahead and raise them a bunch of money.
And keep in mind, when you're doing this crowdfunding, if you're contributing to a crowdfunding, it is a gift. It's not a donation.
Yeah, but it's not a tax-deductible donation. In 2017, I sold a rental house and took a $40,000 note. In 2017, I received $944 in interest, but have not issued a 1099 INT. I did report the amount on my personal 2017. What should my next step be? Wait until 2019 or file now? So he's the one who holds the note. He was paid interest. What are you going to say?
This is kind of a darn if you do and darn if you don't. There is a penalty for not issuing the 1099. You did the right thing by reporting the amount of interest. However, there's a penalty for not filing the 1099. There's a penalty for filing it late.
What's the penalty like?
It's $25. I think it's $50 or $75. Yeah. I think it's $50 of 1099.
So what he's saying is do it next year. Can I just make it really?
I didn't hear anything. So yeah. Go ahead.
Hey, do it next year unless they start digging in. And I've had that. We actually went through a super audit here once, and they went through they let you fix it. So I just wouldn't do it. I would just do it next year and say, hey, whoops. How to aggregate all properties. What are the disadvantages to doing so? You file an aggregation election. Is it a form, or are you just checking a box?
It's an election. It prints out a form with your tax return. It says exactly what properties or investments you're aggregating together. The only real disadvantage is once you've aggregated these properties, let's say you have two houses and one has significant passive losses. Mm-hmm. When you become a real estate professional, those passive losses get stuck in there. Now, normally they get freed up when you sell that property, but once you aggregate your properties, it's all considered one property. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't free up those, if you have large losses tied up, it doesn't free them up until you get rid of all your aggregated properties.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Nicely put. Are the purchase and sale of mortgage notes considered real estate for real estate professional status, I'm assuming?
This is my gut feeling. I would say no. It's more of a lending, more of an investment in notes.
Depends on whether you're ending up with the properties. Depends on what your intent is. And if your intent is just to buy and sell mortgage notes, then you're dealing with lending. In order to be real estate, it's really got to be focused in on the purchase and sale of real estate.
So we kind of run into the same thing with construction companies and such, that they meet the test for certain things, but not for other tests. Mm-hmm. There are input to it. So real estate broker is kind of the same thing.
But here's the thing. So this is Dean. Dean, if I'm in your shoes, I am documenting the time I'm spending in real estate. And so even though I may be going after a note, if the reason that you're going after the note is with the intent to possibly end up with that property, and you do the research and you can back it up, then you add it into the real estate column as far as your time. And you aggregate all your time. The only time this is going to come up is if somebody audits you and goes through all of your records that thoroughly, which is just, it's rare that that happens. But let's say that it does, then you're the one who's tracking all of your expenses and your time. And then it would be up to the IRS to sit there and say, hey, that was actually for the mortgage. And so the old adage is pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. You don't take all of it, but you aggregate out a little bit of it.
Can I bring up a pet peeve?
Mm-hmm.
I hear on the radio frequently about all these auditors that IRS has hired, and they haven't had a real hiring since 2010.
They are so toast right now.
The last big hiring they did most recently was to do with Obamacare for that audit purposes, but really they're dealing with almost a skeleton crew anymore.
Yep. We just got proposed tax forms for 2018. We don't even know. And we just had proposed regulations issued on the tax changes 2 weeks ago, Yeah, they're way behind the eight ball. And sometimes we put ourselves in a disadvantage. It's, you know, again, don't be crazy about it, but you can be pretty aggressive. And especially if it's the truth. If what you're spending your time on is real estate, count it towards real estate. So if you're doing real estate investing part-time, can you be considered a part-time investor? Yeah, you'd be a part-time investor, but you wouldn't be a real estate professional. So the biggest important thing, and this is for Darlene and Ken, is to document your time. And if you go over 750 hours and it's more than you spend on anything else, then you're going to be a real estate professional. Otherwise, you're just an investor unless you are buying properties to sell them. So when you say investing, that means you're going to hold on to them. You're letting them appreciate a little bit, but you're getting the cash flow. Does time spent lending money on real estate for real estate qualify as real estate professional? No, investing. I think we just answered that one. It depends on your real intent of investing in the notes. A lot of people are buying notes to end up with the real estate, in which case then I'd say probably.
Now, what if she's gap funding instead?
If you're gap funding, then I would say no, then you're lending. So you're really going to have to take a look at the totality of the circumstances. So I wish I could say yes or no. What we want is a yes, and there's a way to get there. So it's making sure that you're documenting things to support your position. And we could dig into that a little bit more for you. If you want to shoot us the email, then let us dig into it. Then the next Tax Tuesday, I can answer that one, and Jeff can answer that one with a little bit of research behind it. Nexus question. I'm a resident of California, moving to Arizona. Woohoo! I plan to keep a single-family rental in California. The California house is in a land trust owned by a Wyoming LLC. Does California have the right to tax my pension income after I move in addition to my income in California rental? Shelley, the answer is it depends on where the rental was earned and whether you're taking it out over a 10-year period. Then the answer is no, and my guess is that you're going to be a big no. They will be able to tax technically the rental income that is being derived from California, but for the most part, that's going to be zero.
Yeah, and a really important number to remember when you have the property in more than one state is 183. That's typically the number of days you need to spend in a state to be a resident in that state.
Yep. How do I get the 501c3 tax exempt? Marie, that's the 1023 application.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, so I just you think I just sit in the corner and pick my nose. No. Yeah, it's the 1023 application. So with a nonprofit, it's, you know, I always look at these things in threes. We file with the state, which is a corporation. We document it to make sure there's no shareholders, which is for private parties. And then we file with the feds and we're telling them we want to be an exempt organization. And that exemption is done via 1023. So we go through that process. When we set them up, we've set up about 3,000 of them successfully. How do you create an LLC and an IRA? Darlene and Ken, what you do is you have the IRA custodian enter into a contract with a company like us, and we create the LLC. Or we set up a 401k, roll the IRA into it, and then we let you do it so you don't need the custodian. Is this recorded and will replay be sent out? Robin, it's made available to anybody who's platinum. And then I'm cutting it out a bunch of the Q&As and we'll throw them all over the internet. But the recording, yes, we record them. And join Platinum. It's fun. If I sell it's $35 a month. Whopping. All right. If I sell a partial note to a family member for my QRP, is that disqualified? It depends on the type of family member. If it's one of your kids, yes. If it's to a brother or sister, no. Then you can do it. When you make a contribution, and that's just the whole disqualified person argument we had earlier. So you could always ask the question specific to your situation, and we'll give you a very specific answer. But just know that if you sell a partial note out of your QRP, it depends on the relationship of the family member. If it's lineal, you have a problem, which means kids, 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 parents, grandparents, you have a problem. If it's horizontal, siblings, not a problem. And if it's the spouses of the disqualified person, you're going to have a problem. Investing in LLC for holding rental property, how does one avail to a 1031 exchange? Here's how it works. So I'm not going to worry about this. So Paul, I'm just going to just give you this. The 1031 exchange, you have to have a 1031 exchange facilitator. And it, like the LLC, has to buy the next property. So you sell one and buy one within 180 days. And there's some other rules in there about when you identify it. Or you do a reverse exchange where you buy the replacement property and then sell the appropriate other property within 180 days. But in either case, it's in the name of the LLC. You don't have to do anything else. I should be able to still qualify as an investor and still be active in real estate by investing more than 750 hours. Yes, but it actually is a full-time job. So if you have a full-time job as a real estate professional, then you're good. But remember, your activity as a real estate investor has to exceed your activities of any other profit-making activity. So if you work and you work 1,500 hours, even if you did 1,400 hours as real estate, you are not a real estate professional. It's still below that 1,500. If you are an invest funds to have an equity in a project, oh my God, this one's going to kill me, built by someone else in the intent. I'm trying to think of what this is. So you're investing funds for a piece of an LLC in which you are passive and they are a builder. Are you a dealer? So Judith, no, you are a passive investor in an active business is what you are. So I see what you're saying. What she's asking is, hey, I have Bob the Builder comes up to me and says, hey, we're going to build this big apartment complex. We're going to develop it and everything. You put in $100,000. Everybody else puts $100,000. You are passive. You are not considered the dealer. Here's a fun one. Did you already read this one?
No, I haven't read this one.
Okay. I am planning to receive Social Security benefits at 62 and currently not employed. I do private lending to real estate investors through promissory notes. So I do receive interest income in the amount of $40,000, $50,000. Will this affect my Social Security benefits? At what point does Social Security benefits are taxable? So Joe, the answer is that there are certain types of income that are exempt from calculation of the Social Security? Jeff, do you know off the top of your head?
If you're receiving earned income, and that's all Social Security is going to ever know about. So we're talking about self-employment income, W-2 wages. That's going to affect your Social Security benefits.
Mm-hmm. But if you're just receiving interest income, is it going to affect it?
Well, here's the thing. If you're in the business of lending money, we would typically set you up as a business, mm-hmm. either on Schedule C or through an S-Corp or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that interest you receive wouldn't be interest income. It would be business income. You'd be able to deduct certain expenses from that income.
We'd have to look at it because usually you're going to want to be treated as active. In this particular case, you're not going to want to be treated as active.
The downside of this is any money, any net income you have from this business of lending money, mm-hmm. it's going to affect your Social Security until you're 65 or your 67 full retirement age.
Yeah, so we're going to have to, Joe, the answer is we may want to isolate it into its own taxable entity so that it doesn't affect you. We may.
I kind of feel like this would be a great place for an S corporation. It's not earned income flowing through to him. And
would he have to take a salary?
No.
See?
Yeah, there we go.
See, I'm going to have to take a look. Joe, that's a great question. Could you submit it to the webinars at Anderson Advisors so we can research it? And that way we can hit it in 2 weeks, too, and get you a much more thoroughly researched. Because you're asking a very complicated question that's just not going to be off the top of our head. We're going to have to make sure that we don't step on a landmine.
So the answer is maybe.
Yeah. My wife and I are the only shareholders, and we both take a one-third salary. No, you should take about one-third of the net profit as salary total between the owners. So greater than 2% shareholders or, you and your spouse. So you could each take – I'll throw numbers out. Let's say you made 100. You could each take up to 18.5 if you're under 50 and immediately dump it into a 401k and not pay any tax. So, hey, we like that. We have a medical coding business. Perfect. Yeah. So that's one where we want to take a look at. This is so much fun. Really appreciate it. I hope that's not sarcastic, Al. I opened a couple of LLCs, but I haven't used them to purchase flipping. Kind of put them on hold until I do. Do I have to do tax returns? It all depends on what you're doing. With those, the answer is yes, you could put them on ice. Thanks for the answer on UBIT. Diane, no problem. See, we actually do answer questions here. What are the legal benefits of incorporating in Puerto Rico, if any, compared to Nevada? If you live there, I think they give you like a 4% tax rate, but you actually have to reside there. So there's legal benefits, not really any, other than the tax benefits. And in the fact of the matter is Puerto Rico is Spanish law, which means they could probably take your company from you. But you could still go down there. And Jeff,
there are certain industries that have great tax benefits. Pharmaceutical companies was always a big one. Some of those old laws have sunsetted, but it might be a good opportunity.
Cool. Look at all these questions. All right. Some people are saying nice things. Great. I like nice things. It's better than... You guys are jerks. All right. In 2017, I was self-employed under my LLC. I have not filed my taxes yet and have not contributed any retirement. Would I still be able to do that? What are the best options? Casey, are you under, this is self-employment under my LLC. So it depends on whether, it's an S-Corp. Did you file an extension because you would be able to do a retirement plan, either a SEP IRA, or if you already had the 401k, then you can make a contribution from the company for it. It'd either be a 401a or a 401k or a SEP IRA. I think those are going to be your.
And if you do have extension, you have 11 days to get it done.
Yeah, you have 11 days. Casey, get off your butt. All right. Friend wants advice with the startup pre-revenue. He's offering 10% stock. Not sure I want ownership that's subject to capital calls, expectation, potential taxes. Is it better to take an option, warrant, or some other scenario until there's more value in the company? It really depends. So, Clark, nice to see you. Awesome. I know Clark's brother very well. Studs, nice family. All right, friends. So if I was going to have a piece, the whole thing is if I'm putting money into an endeavor, it's going to be what am I going to get out? And it would really depend on the agreement. I don't want to be subject to having to put more money in, nor do I want my interest necessarily being diluted by somebody who is. And so one of the ways you can do it is sometimes do it as a convertible note where you loan the money So you know you can at least get it back, but it's convertible into equity at the fair market value at that time. And you guys can actually agree to this ahead of time. So that if you decide you want to contribute it and you see they're doing what you want, then you convert it into equity. Otherwise, it just remains a note that they pay you on. Clark, that's probably the route I would go.
Now, the assumption here is that this is a C corporation he's talking about.
I don't even care.
Well, if it's an S corporation, we wouldn't be able to have all these secondary notes and stuff. And
if it's an S, I could still convert it.
Could you?
Yep. I could still, but you know,
as long as it converts into the same.
Yep. The risk is I don't want to have a convertible debt to anything other than an individual that would qualify for S.
Okay.
But I don't see S corps raising money this way. It's almost always C corps or partnerships. So in the ones that I've been personally involved in, we did three levels of financing this exact way with Vegas Tech Fund. That's the little Tony Shea group, and they dumped a bunch of money into a company called Roll Tech. You can look them up online because we exited that one with a sale to Brunswick. And the way they did all their money was purely, that was a C corp, but it was purely through convertible notes. All right. What are the best tools you could recommend for tracking time, mileage, and expenses for real estate investors? My desire to be paperless and get everything out of it. So, people use TaxBot for mileage. It's Mile IQ, I think is the one that I use. But if you're tracking time, it's just using, sometimes it's just using your calendar or a spreadsheet. Let's see, is full-time realtor a real estate professional? Chances are you're going to aggregate all that in. I executed a 1031 exchange where our trust owned the old property, sold it, and took title of the upleg property in the trust using 1031 exchange intermediary, but now I want to transfer upleg property into an LLC. Diane, there is no time restriction that you have to hold it as long as you are the one who's still the end beneficiary. If you extend loan through an LLC owned by your Roth IRA, then want to transfer sell the remainder of a then season note to a lower interest rate, can the Roth continue to receive the full payment from the borrower and then relay the portion? Yes, as long as it's non-convertible, same as you do in an S corp. Is the answer the same of a self-administered S-401k? So what they're asking is, if you extend a loan through, and we're just going to call it the Roth IRA because the LLC looks right into it, so from a tax standpoint, and then you sell the remainder of the then season note, so you start collecting, and then you sell the note because it's doing really well, and you say, hey, does anybody want to pay me for this? I know a guy that actually, that's what he does, is he puts the notes together, then he sells his notes out, and then he can get the money to go do another one. And he aggregates them all together. They call it flying in flocks. The lenders flock together, and they do a loan, and then he sells his portion. Yeah, you could sell it, and then you could continue to receive it and keep a portion of it. The only issue you have is if it's a convertible note, then you wouldn't want to do a convertible note because – boom, that Roth IRA, depending on the type of entity, if it's an S-Corp, you'd kill the S-Corp status of it. How do you put an LLC on hold? You quite literally do nothing with it, or you just pay the state, and then you file a non-activity return. You just say it's not doing anything. So you're allowed to do that, or you just do nothing, which is kind of what I tend to do. It just depends on your state. If there's not much penalty, then I just kind of sit it, and then 2 years later, I might reactivate it. Will real estate holding LLC taxes partnership qualify for the 20% pass-through deduction? Yes, it will. And here's the deal. So as long as it's not triple net property. So what she's asking is, hey, I have a whole bunch of LLCs and they all receive rental income and there's a net income amount. Let's say it comes through with 50 grand. There's something called a 199A deduction that was enacted by the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And it gives you a 20% deduction off that amount or 20% of your taxable income, whichever one is less. But if you earn over a certain amount, so for individuals, it's over 150, so 157.5. If it's a married couple, it's 315,000. It's going to make your head hurt. I'm going just off of memory here.
I'm saying how far you're going to take this.
I could keep going. Then you scale up and then you have a new test. It's 50% of the W-2 income that's being paid on that particular business or 25% of its W-2 income and 2.5% of its property. See, we tax geeks love this stuff. No, we don't. Nobody likes this stuff. So the answer is yes,
but you may have some phase outs that we're going to have to be cognizant of. We can control your income, though, because at the end of the day, it's taxable income and not adjusted gross income. That's the important part, which means we can make contributions to retirement plans, give to 501c3s, offset money through a C Corp. There are tools that we have. And Eva, it's considered pass-through income. And yes, it's already been handled by the proposed regs. The only type of rental income that's not included is when you do a triple net lease on commercial property because you literally are doing nothing. That is it. We've gone way over again. Jeff, you're talking too much.
I know. Can't shut me up.
I know. Anyway, shoot your questions to webinar@andersonadvisors.com. These are fun. Or again, we're gonna break them into pieces and start sending them out. If you are platinum, you can come in and listen again. I feel pretty confident about this. There was a couple of you guys that asked some very unique questions that I would love it if you would email me so we can research them for the next one. If you have any questions that come up and you like these long multi-part questions, feel free to email them. And if you're okay with it, just what we do is we'll just pull your last name out of it and we will make sure that we are answering your questions, you know, so that we're not violating your privacy, but that we're getting a benefit to the group. Thanks, guys. Until next time. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.